Transformation of America by Mark Phillips and Kathy O'Brien. Chapter 4, Truth and Consequences. Justice Pursued and Justice Denied. Our much-anticipated arrival into the Seattle, Washington, International Airport Terminal heralded a new beginning. Kathy appeared to be openly optimistic that perhaps, at long last, Kelly would soon have her chance for recovery. Privately, I felt much less hopeful. I knew from past personal experiences and through my insider sources that mental health physicians from the private sector of society had little acquaintance with secret U.S. government mind control research. The only mind control information these doctors had access to for the most part was from the hysterical comments supplied them by their troubled patients. Hysteria, in this case, as a symptom of misinformation, is highly contagious, and therefore spread throughout the mental health profession. Many practitioners displayed symptoms of the ostrich syndrome to me, their peers, and patients through fear and chronic denial. It was 1990, the beginning of the last decade of this century and the millennium, and most mental health physicians remained in a state of denial concerning the existence of mind control. Mental health as a science is barely 100 years of age. Truly an industry in its infancy in relation to the other recognized healing arts. Due to mental health's infancy and the fact that it is rooted in the archaic, mystical theories of Jung and Freud, combined with the non-availability of government-controlled research information, the term mental health is viewed by patients and doctors alike as an oxymoron. Patients I have interviewed who suffer from dissociative disorders frequently refer to the profession as mental health and their well-intentioned provider as the rapist. Unfortunately for all parties concerned, in many reported instances these cruel labels are consistent with the quality of the care provided. Whereas I strongly support, in concept, the healing arts existing in the fields of mental health that could be applied in the treatment of mind control patients, I cannot foresee their application in meeting the needs of these patients without some radical changes in our National Security Act. Around 1970, I recall witnessing a mild case in point. I was overseeing the videotaping of a top-secret psychiatric experiment involving a young man who had suffered brain damage resulting from some type of severe head trauma. This patient was ambulatory. He could not remember anything, express himself, or for that matter, think. He was not brain dead. He was mind dead. Through the application of a combination of experimental drugs and high-tech electronic technology involving harmonics, his brain was being retrained to permit constructed thought processes to commence. The brain scar tissue that was inhibiting his ability to think was being chemically and electronically bypassed. I equated this experimental procedure to the hot wiring of an ignition switch of an automobile to preclude the use of a key. The extraordinary procedure and subsequent results of this experimental therapy was meticulously recorded. The record, tape, and doctor notes were dropped into a security envelope and were taken by courier to Fort George Meade, Maryland. What made this case so memorable was the event that immediately followed. I overheard the experiment's attending physician complaining bitterly to his nurse colleague that his patient in an adjoining ward, who was not a dog guinea pig, through application of this method, could probably recover. The doctor's complaint addressed his being prohibited from applying state-of-the-art treatment for his patient by virtue of his dod oath of secrecy. This doctor was frustrated at being forced to serve two masters. The dod being one master held control over his career through his medical license, liability insurance, and the secrecy oath he had signed. The second master was the doctor's own moral and ethical standards, supported by the Hippocratic oath he had signed upon becoming a physician. Thus, without benefit of the voluminous Dodd research findings and technology developments, the medical field of mental health is in its learning curve for establishing models to provide patients state-of-the-art care. In other words, Mental health providers themselves are quickly becoming the second group of mind/information control victims. The mental health profession is in a state of crisis and has arrived at the proverbial crossroads of failure and success. The road to success through the application of available technologies appears to be blocked for reasons of national security. As a direct result of DoD management of mind research secrets and the resulting federal information containment practices, mental health providers are on the defensive with their patients, the courts, and more recently with certain special interest action groups. These groups are attacking the mental health professional as a target for destruction. Well-funded organizations with very questionable agendas, such as the False Memory Foundation, FMF, and the Church of Scientology, have publicly denounced mental health as a profession. The Church of Scientology has emerged as the apparent leader in publicly denouncing the mental health profession. Through the Church's Washington, D.C. based human rights lobby group, it has launched a massive negative propaganda campaign accompanied by numerous lawsuits against ethical drug companies and mental health providers. Scientologists believe their church's founder, L. Ron Hubbard, has discovered a cure-all for mental illness through behavior modification. Hubbard, a successful science fiction writer, allegedly acquired knowledge of subliminal mind control through his military service with U.S. Navy intelligence. He named his behavioral modification program Dianetics after his first wife, Diane. The False Memory Foundation is a lobby group which is primarily utilized by persons charged with sexual abuse. The FMF is desperately attempting to develop legislation that restricts therapy for persons suffering from dissociative disorders as a result of trauma. This organization's stated beliefs include that repressed memory is a myth. FMF has found the mental health profession's Achilles heel. To date, the model for developing an effective therapy regime for dissociative disorders, which are as a result of repeated trauma, has not been published by either the American Psychiatric Association or the American Psychological Association. The difficulty in developing a model is due to a number of factors. The primary factor involves national security secrets concerning classified mind control research. In the present climate, referring mind control victims to mental health professionals for treatment would be tantamount to subjecting a patient needing delicate surgery to a surgeon who was blindfolded and handcuffed. The knowledge of these conditions produced the private opinion I withheld from Kathy when she professed optimism for Kelly's latest recovery opportunity. Nevertheless, Kathy was nearing complete recovery and we both recognized we were doing all we could at the moment to provide for Kelly's needs. Perhaps identifying who within our government is interested in withholding vital medical research findings and technologies information from the mental health profession could provide a foundation of understanding. From my personal experiences while working for Capital International Airways, I formed a strong opinion that addresses this question. However, the answer that mirrors my perception was later eloquently provided by a Washington, D.C. news correspondent and journalist, Linda Hunt, in her book Secret Agenda. The historical basis for this book are the declassified DoD documents identifying Project Paperclip as being the secret importation/relocation of Nasser and fascist scientists into the United States over a 40-year period. These brilliant criminal scientists were primarily focused on two areas of research, rockets and the mind. They were placed in positions of authority in, among others, prestigious universities, colleges, industries, and NASA. Over the years, these imported criminals have directly influenced our society with advanced rocket technologies and mind control applications through U.S. government-sponsored research. According to Secret Agenda, Nazism, as a philosophy and form of government, is alive and destroying our country, in part, as a result of Project Paperclip. I can attest to this statement from personal knowledge gained during my employment at Capital International Airways, which is named as one of the primary transporters for Project Paperclip. These were background facts for some of the thoughts that rushed through my mind on our long drive from Seattle to the southeastern US. I was anxious to discover the end results of my telephone campaign in the pursuit of justice I had waged while in Alaska. Our first destination would be Huntsville, Alabama. This southern U.S. city is famous for its tourism centerpiece, the NASA-owned U.S. Space and Rocket Center. The town also boasts of being home to more Pentagon, black budget, U.S. dollars per capita than any place in America. Kathy harbors a very different opinion of this town, its police force, and the NASA research facility. For Kathy and Kelly, Huntsville had been a place they were regularly taken to by Alex Houston for high-tech torture and the production of child and adult pornography films. This trip to Huntsville would be different for Kathy, except for one aspect of her previous experiences. Both she and I would receive our first threat to our lives in our pursuit of justice from law enforcement. This was surprising to me and normal for Kathy. The lead-up to this threat began with my phone call to a Huntsville-based legal aid group known as the National Association of Child Advocates. This organization publicized that it was formed through the leadership efforts of the local district attorney Bud Grammer, who is known to his constituents as Gun Ban Bud. After supplying this advocacy center with Kathy's recollections of her past experiences in Huntsville, we were contacted by two Huntsville City Police Department vice detectives. Their names were Jeff Bennett and Chuck Crabtree. Upon our arrival into Huntsville, these two vice cops escorted us and our trailer to a local apartment used for staging drug buys. The place was furnished, complete with audio and video bugs throughout every room. When I asked Bennett if their place was bugged, he flatly denied it. From this lie I knew, with certainty that Kathy and I were there to be specimens for whomever to study. I knew who, and we gave them our best performance to mislead them. This action probably saved our lives. After weeks of delays, the two vice cops sat down with Kathy and me for discussion. She supplied them a myriad of testimony including detailed physical descriptions of two particular perpetrators, their names, and location maps of where they lived and allegedly produced child and adult pornography. The two perpetrators, themselves Huntsville policemen, were also helpful assets in the campaign for electing District Attorney Bud Grammer. Their names were Audie Majors and Sergeant Frank Crowell. After Kathy had exhausted all of her recollections, Crabtree and Bennett ordered us to leave Huntsville now while we were still alive, and shut up if we intended to stay that way. Later, Kathy and I would learn that Crabtree and Bennett had notified every law enforcement officer in over five states to whom we had provided information. They reported that we were a pair of professional con artist criminals. Perhaps they were able to accomplish this discrediting tactic as a result of police reports we filed in other states, which included a reference to our bad experience with the Huntsville Police Department. In addition, the Nashville office of the FBI was responsible for perpetrating Crabtree's and Bennett's discrediting lies. This FBI action ceased after resident agent in charge Ben Bursa was told by a friendly district attorney that I now could prove the identity and prosecute those responsible for the character assassination. The harassment stopped. It is interesting to note that Bud Grammer would in less than a year be elected to Congress. Within months after his election, Bud was rewarded for years of alleged containment practices. Allegedly, Bud has been covering up investigations for the intelligence community, DOD, and of course his number one financial supporter, NASA. The wife of an Atlanta, Georgia physician, Miss Fayager, did however survive Bud's wrath in court. Her crime was advocating for and protecting a child who had been horribly abused. This courageous lady had her day in court and won. Now she has filed a countersuit in federal court. Reeling from Bud's second-hand threats to our lives, we returned to Nashville. Here we learned that the Kentucky VIP Hospital Administration had suddenly declared Kelly's state of Alaska medical records to be in error. VIP said she was fine. This statement was supplemented by, "You best come here now and pick her up or we'll give her to Kentucky Child Services and they will find adoptive parents." This was a terrifying development since Kelly could not function outside a restrictive environment. She had been declared suicidal and homicidal by three attending physicians and / therapists. Kathy and I were homeless. We brought Kelly back to Tennessee where she, Kathy and I stayed in my mother's tiny two-bedroom home. This living arrangement would not last. Kelly's asthma program, destined to separate her from her mother, returned within 48 hours. We rushed her, gasping for breath, to Vanderbilt Hospital in Nashville for emergency treatment. Again, Kelly's condition worsened to the extremely critical point, then returned to normal. Her attending doctor thought he had seen a real miracle until he learned about mind control. Vanderbilt Hospital physicians who reviewed Kelly's past medical and psychiatric records recommended that she be moved to the worst child warehouse we've seen so far, Crockett/Cumberland House, the home for broken butterflies, see photo. Because Kathy and I were both unemployed and Kelly only had Medicaid insurance, the state of Tennessee demanded temporary custody. Their demands for custody were legally legitimate and morally equated to extortion, for they had no intentions of seeking expert therapy for Kelly. Through a lengthy 2-year court proceeding, with 5 lawyers opposing Kathy, we had a partial victory. Kelly was transferred to Charter Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee, where again she did not receive MPD/DID therapy, but for the first time did receive genuine empathy from a social worker, Abbott Jordan. During this period, my life and liberty was threatened by the Nashville Metro Police Department. This verbal death threat was delivered by Metro Homicide Captain Mickey Miller and echoed by his friend and subordinate Lieutenant Tommy Jacobs. Miller said, "You best forget this woman. Walk away from all this now before your health changes." Jacobs said, "There's nothing wrong with that kid that her father, Cox, can't fix. She just has allergies. You'd best forget you ever heard of either one of them. I have all this conversation on audio tape." Within a few months of these threats came others threatening both our lives and liberty from every branch of law enforcement within the state of Tennessee. This included the Nashville office of the FBI. The latter was in the form of a clerical mistake on the part of the FBI that was to be a frame-up for my supposedly threatening the President of the United States, George Bush. This charge was totally groundless and was subsequently dropped, but only after I secured a lawyer. It was now 1991, and Kathy and I had determined that we must proceed with Phase 2 of our pursuit of justice through a well-organized information dissemination campaign. The funding for this project would indirectly come from the assistance of Bill Ross, who also provided constant moral support. Kathy and I have always felt uncomfortable exposing gentle persons like Bill Ross to such horrific information as pertains to trauma-based mind control. However, we have learned over the years through our public speaking engagements and consultations with physicians and others that, generally speaking, people appreciate knowing why they are no longer at the top of the food chain. Bill Ross, like hundreds of others, never gave up hope that we would live to tell our story. 5 years have passed since we returned from Alaska. The lessons learned through this trailblazing effort in our pursuit of justice should never be taught to anyone. No person should have to experience the heartache, desperation, and grinding poverty that Kathy, Kelly, and I have had to live with during the winding down portion of our information dissemination campaign. Kathy approached me with an idea she thought could help us win public support. She had repeatedly commented that she wanted to rescue Sadina Dinah Redd, daughter of actor/singer Jerry Reed of Smokey and the Bandit fame. According to Kathy, she had been used repeatedly in pornography productions with Sadina over the years and had bonded with this once beautiful woman. Sadina's husband, David Rurick, also known as Dave Rowe, was then her alleged sadistic handler. It is noteworthy that Rowe allegedly received his training on how to maintain a slave, using specific tortures, from Alex Houston. Roe lived and reportedly loved with Houston before he met Sadina. Kathy and I naively believed at the time that Jerry Redd was not involved in his daughter's enslavement, as was Kathy's father. Furthermore, we were convinced that Jerry Redd, with his numerous connections into politics and the entertainment industry, could be a powerful ally. This was not to be. I rescued Sadina, and in minutes after the rescue, she began talking, but not until I had discussed my plan in person with her famous father and his agent at a Brentwood, Tennessee restaurant. Redd had more than enough time to warn Roe that I was armed and on my way to his house. All evidences disappeared. Years later, a U.S. Customs Enforcement officer informed me that I had somehow been connected to Redd, possibly Redd himself, suggesting I might be blackmailing him. This clean customs officer knew I had rescued Sadina from Roe's enslavement and that I had audio taped all meetings with Sadina, Jerry Redd, and his wife, Chrissy. He was openly concerned for my safety and that Redd was lying so as to frighten me away. Within 2 months after the rescue, Sadina and her mother filed criminal charges, including sexual child abuse, of Sadina's 4-year-old son, against Roe. A spook informant working within the Nashville District Attorney's Office alerted me to these charges and the anticipated outcome. No action was taken for reasons of national security. Sadina had been prostituted to, among many others, heads of state, and to the Arabian ambassador to the U.S., Prince Bandar bin Sultan. According to an involved witnesses of one of her encounters with Bandar, a friend of George Bush, she was one of his favorite slaves. We've never heard from Sadina or any member of her family since the rescue. This trek through hell in our pursuit of justice taught nothing to Kathy that she had not already been told by her abusers. For me, I learned the hard way that our Constitution was only a beautiful plan that had been stolen, plundered, and replaced for reasons of national security. Today, Kathy, Kelly, I, and all true patriots stand at the proverbial crossroads of revolution or evolution. Through armed revolution, we patriots will perish, and the emergence of a totally government-controlled society will herald in another period of dark ages. As a proud gun owner, armed with inside knowledge, I know we are technologically outgunned. Whereas if we choose to evolve through the challenges to our psyche that developed communication technology is present, we can reinstate our constitution and set our people free. Revolution or evolution, change in life as we know it is inevitable. Each of us must now take a stand to commit a portion of our individual time and diminishing resources to support the action groups and individuals who are not afraid to work at taking back our government through mass exposure of its crimes. We must seek new leaders who will be committed to doing the most with the least. These leaders share the battle cry that silence does, indeed, equal death. 6 Hunt, Linda, Secret Agenda, St. Martin's Press, 1991.